for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to learn more about this podcast, go to the website lastborninthewilderness.com. Everything you need to know will be on that website. If you look down in the description of the episode, you will see a link to the website and everything else you need to know about this project. Here's the episode. First off, I just want to thank Jonathan there for recording that introduction for me. As with the last episode, you're going to hear some new voices there for the introductions and for the outros as well. So Jonathan, thank you very much for agreeing to do that. I really appreciate it. In this episode, I speak with Will Falk. Will is a writer, lawyer, and an environmental activist. He's a former public defender. And in this episode, what I wanted to do is talk with Will about his experiences, his understandings, his legal as well as personal understandings surrounding the U.S. legal system, especially when it comes to granting rights to nature. So, for instance, granting rights to a lake or a river or a forest or any of natural entities that exist, whether the legal system in the United States is able and even capable of providing anything like rights for these natural beings. Now, under the U.S. legal system, it's predicated upon the assumption, on the belief, on the myth that non-human life is essentially, effectively, property. Especially when we talk about lakes, when we talk about rivers, we talk about watersheds, when we talk about anything like that, it's reduced to property. It's reduced to something that's inanimate, something that can be used and exploited by human beings. But when we talk about things like, for instance, Lake Erie, which is a water source for many people in that region, including, as we discussed, we talk about the people of Toledo and their campaign to end the toxic algae blooms that are getting worse year after year as a result of runoff from agriculture, big ag businesses, and the like. It's directly impacting the quality of the water for these people. So the people of Toledo, as Will explains, they tried their very best and they went through every procedure, every legal step required to get a Bill of Rights on the ballot in their local elections. And I wanted to focus on this case in particular with Will because Will, one, he's a lawyer. I am absolutely atrocious and terrible at understanding law. My legal vocabulary is practically non-existent. So having him come on and to explain this process and to explain why the legal system, in particular in this case with Lake Erie Bill of Rights for the people of Toledo, how even after they went through every single step, they jumped through every hoop, they did everything that you're supposed to do, and even in spite of that, it was shut down. Will explains why that is and how we can use this as a case study, and there's numerous other examples that we can look to. There are numerous case studies in the United States that show that the government and its corporate allies have no interest severely cutting back anything that's going to hinder corporate profits and go up against some of the long-standing beliefs and underlying assumptions that are embedded deeply within the very system itself, right? That's the whole point of this, is to understand that our government, our socioeconomic system has no interest in protecting resources for the sake of it. Even if it is in the case, as we see with the people of Toledo, where it's actually polluting their drinking water. So this episode, what I really wanted to get at with Will, and what Will advocates, is that he is a lawyer. He has done, and he has seen, and he has witnessed, and he's participated in cases that, regardless of how well they are organized, how well they are funded, how sound they are, they get shut down. And why is that? And if we're to understand that is a part of the system itself, and it is embedded within it, then we can start to ask more, well, direct but maybe difficult questions about what is to be done. I actually want to quote something here. It's from an article that Will co-wrote with Sean Butler titled "Questioning Unquestioned Beliefs, What the Lake Erie Bill of Rights Teaches Us." Quote, "Perhaps surprisingly, one of the unquestioned beliefs authorizing ecocide is the belief that we live in a democracy and, because we live in a democracy, that our government reflects the will of the governed. This mistaken belief leads to more mistaken beliefs, including a belief that the best way to make change is to petition your elected representatives, and if they won't listen, to elect new ones who will. This misconception includes the further mistaken belief that the American regulatory framework exists to protect the natural world and the humans who depend on her, and that therefore, filing lawsuits under the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts can stop the destruction of endangered species, our habitat, and the air and water we require. We should all know the truth by now. We do not live in a democracy, and our government was never intended to reflect the will of the governed. Our elected representatives only listen to us when the corporations they're beholden to aren't telling them what to do. The regulatory framework does not exist primarily to protect the natural world. It exists to issue permits, to give permission, to legalize the harm corporate projects wreak on the natural world, and to make it near impossible for the citizenry to oppose these projects." End quote. So the fact of the matter is, and this is what Will points to, is that we don't live in a democracy. The assumptions that we have still about how this is all supposed to work is largely built on huge misconceptions about how power works in this country. So we need to understand that, and if we're going to stop the industrial machine, this industrial culture, from destroying every living being on this planet, every living place, the living planet itself, if it's going to continuously destroy and seek to extract as much value, economic value, out of it for as long as possible, we have to take matters into our own hands. And Will and I come to this conclusion in this episode, and we explain why. So please enjoy this interview with Will. I think Will is an incredibly beautiful human being. He has a book that's coming out in August, the title of which is How Dams Fall, on representing the Colorado River in the first ever American lawsuit seeking rights for a major ecosystem. I'm excited to read it. From everything I'm hearing about it, it sounds beautiful and worthy of a purchase and a read, absolutely. So look out for that. I'll provide a link to that down below in the description so you can look at that, and hopefully you can pre-order it or you can get it when it comes out. And if you want to learn more about Will, you can go to his website, willfalk.org. And Will also, in discussing the Lake Erie Bill of Rights, we talk about the people of Toledo and Toledoans for Safe Water. It's an organization. I'll provide a link to their website and also a link to the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which Will works with as well. I'll provide links to all of these things in the description of this episode. So without any further delay, here is my interview with Will Falk. All right. Well, Will, thank you for agreeing to speak with me. Last time we spoke was, I think it was in January. It was the first time that we had ever talked to each other. The Unistoten camp, up in British Columbia, which is a part of the, Wet'suwet'en, First Nation, there were some pretty dramatic, things going on at the time with that camp. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police? Am I saying that correctly? I always get like the words mixed. I always say like Royal Mounted Canadian Police. It sounds kind of off. But the Canadian, they were basically a paramilitary force, breached their checkpoints and, forced their way in so that a pipeline could be constructed. And, I was kind of wanting so badly to talk about it on the podcast, and, your friend and my friend Will, Max Wilbert, recommended I talk to you because you had spent time at the Unistoten camp back in 2015, I believe. And, you of course are not someone who is a member of that nation. You're not an indigenous person of this land, but you felt compelled at that time to go and help them build some structures, at the camp. And you just were amazing in being able to, in that interview we did, of explaining your personal experience. And then After that interview, I talked to Dr. Carla Tate, who is the program director at the healing center at the Unistoten camp, the Indigenous Healing Center. So I felt it was great because I could talk to you, and you're somebody who, like me, is not, we're not a part of, you know, an Indigenous nation here in the so-called Americas, where we're settlers in every sense of the word. And the fact that you were invited or that you were allowed to come in and participate and help and experience that, I think really allowed for people like me to really get a deeper grasp on how valuable and how important their existence is and what they're trying to accomplish there. And then getting the other perspective from Carla, who is a member of that nation and, you know, was talking about it from that perspective. So I really just want to thank you, Will, for providing that perspective on that interview. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. It was, I really enjoyed the interview, and I was, you know, it was, I love the Unistoten camp and the experiences I had there will, you know, truly stay with me for my entire life. So it was a pleasure to be able to talk about it. And, I really appreciate you giving me the chance to.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think people got a lot out of it too. It was really valuable. And, I wanted to touch base again with you because, you know, while, yeah, you have written about your experiences at the Unistoten camp and you've of course care very deeply about it. You know, I wanted to talk more about your other work, I guess what you're more known for, which is talking about, because you are, of course, you're a lawyer and you're looking at environmentalism, I guess you could say. I almost hate using that word, but it's just, you know, the broad sense of the word of thinking about how to respect and protect the natural world from being desecrated and destroyed by industrialization, development, extraction, all the things that come with an industrial civilization like ours, doing whatever you can to sort of protect those places and those entities. And so I've been researching your work the past several days, and I've been actually just surprised at how, I don't know why I'm surprised, but I guess you know, looking more deeply into your writing and into your work, I'm just like, God, Will, you're doing some, not like what you're doing is so important. And I don't want to try to summarize your work poorly here, but basically what you're doing is you're showing that legally we can do things to, you know, there is like the EPA and there's other, maybe more local forms of, legislation and things like that that can help protect lakes and rivers and forests and things like that. But ultimately the legal system does not work to protect those things. They work to protect corporations and corporate interests. And you have explained in great detail numerous cases where either you've been directly involved in some of those cases or you've just observed them where citizens try to put forward some sort of, you know, legislation or, you know, something to kind of limit, say, the pollution of a Lake Erie, for instance, and stop the algae blooms that are there. I was reading recently a piece that you wrote on that. And how, you know, no matter what everyone did, they followed everything by the book. It should work for them, but it doesn't. And you're just like, this is the reality of the legal system. This is what it works for. And you're speaking as a lawyer. So I think there's a certain weight that comes with your writing and your activism. So anyway, I guess to just stop kind of ranting there, I would just want to ask about your work and what, you know, when you were starting to do environmental activism through the legal framework that we have in the United States, what were your assumptions about the system that were ultimately challenged and potentially upended by your experiences with it? Does that question kind of make sense?
Yeah, I think, yeah, it does. So I think the best way to answer that question is just to kind of explain ultimately, or to explain why I went to law school and the curves and twists and turns that my legal career has taken that, has informed my understanding of the legal system today. And that all starts, I went to law school at the University of Wisconsin, Madison. I went to law school after majoring in English as an undergrad. And as an English major, you're reading the great stories that have been written, and learning how to understand the great stories that have been written about the world, throughout the history of humanity. And one thing that a lot of those stories include, are just, how bad the world has gotten and how destructive humans can be, and how much evil there can be in the world. So as a really naive 22-year-old, I thought going to law school would be the best way that I could take what I've learned through the great literature of the world and through my own experiences of the world, and try and gain a tool, a law license, to try to fix the problems that I saw and that I had been learning about. One of the first things that I realized in law school was that I wanted to be a public defender. I saw the criminal justice system in the United States as inherently racist. I graduated from law school in 2012. There's a really great book called The New Jim Crow by a woman named Michelle Alexander. And in that book, she really explains how the criminal justice system has been taken over to enforce segregation, essentially. And she talks a lot about how things like the war on drugs that was introduced in the 1980s by a very conservative American government, the Reagan administration. She argues that this was essentially a reactionary response to civil rights. And once people of color got civil rights, the reactionary right had to figure out a way to take those away. And the war on drugs was kind of the response. And so I, understanding this, my first instinct was I got to fight back. And the best way I saw to do that was to become a public defender and represent poor people, largely people of color, in their criminal cases. Unfortunately, my understanding was really essentially a liberal understanding of the government. I thought that, I basically saw society as made up of individuals and that my job as an individual was to help other individuals, not become victims of the criminal justice system. Over time, I started to realize that I was really hampered. I graduated from law school and I was hired as a public defender in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which is halfway between Chicago and Milwaukee, on apparently a major drug route. I don't know if that's true, but that's what the cops want us to think. And it was a very segregated county, and almost all of my clients were people of color. So I really saw firsthand how that was true. But early on in my career as a public defender, I learned how limited I was to actually make change. So all lawyers take an oath to uphold the United States Constitution, the state constitution where they're barred in. They are ethically required to represent the wishes of their clients. And this is really problematic because especially in criminal law, when things are happening like prosecutors are overcharging, where they're just piling on offenses for the same basic behavior, and a criminal client is sitting there thinking, well, I can either plead guilty to one of these and the prosecutor will dismiss three or four of the other charges, and I can likely get away with probation, or I can try and fight all these charges. They all have maximum penalties of 2 years in prison. There's five charges here. I'm facing 10 years in prison. Your rational self-interest tells you to plead guilty to one and remove the others and take the less dangerous route. Well, when you are ethically required to do that, when your client wants to do that, you're hardly ever fighting against the system. You can't help anyone really. You're just kind of ensuring that the very worst aspects of the criminal justice system are held in check. You know, you're just trying to make sure that the cops aren't lying, and you're trying to prove that the cops are lying when you can. But all of this is a long way to say that there are structural problems built into the American legal system, whether we're talking about criminal defense or whether we're talking about environmental law, which is what I really want to talk about. But I learned very quickly that there were structural problems. And as a public defender, the best thing I could do was I came up with a little metaphor. I was basically like a battlefield medic. I was out there trying to stop the bleeding for a few people, but I was in no way affecting the war. I could exert no real influence on the structural conditions that we're keeping my community segregated. We're keeping people of color in jail. So I left the public defender's office, and I've always been most passionate about environmental issues. I think that at the end of the day, the most important things, the most pressing issues are environmental issues. It doesn't really matter how many people are in prison if we can't breathe the air or drink the water. So I stepped away from law for a little while and had a series of experiences that really taught me about power, about how to affect change in the real world. You know, we talked about in our last interview my experience at the Una Stoughton camp. One of the things about the Una Stoughton camp that it really educated me about how we can leverage the resources we do have to make change, how we can actually stop destruction from happening. So at a place like the Una Stoughton camp where there's never more, at least when I was there, there was never more than 20 or 30 people at the camp. They were stopping seven pipelines from being built with very few resources. And they were actually making change in the real world. They were actually keeping destruction from happening to their land. So I started to think, you know, they have been involved in the legal system in the past, but they weren't really using the legal system to protect their land. There was sort of an attitude that the Canadian legal system is a colonial legal system, much like the American legal system, and there simply can't be justice in the courts of the oppressors. So why waste our time trying to argue with the oppressors to treat us a little bit better? Why not just actually stop the harm that's coming? Let's actually use what we have to protect ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, did you want to?
Oh, I was just going to say, like, this sparked something where you mentioned earlier about when you approached law, when you first entered that field, you kind of almost had unexamined assumptions, which is about this sort of liberal democracy, this idea that, you know, everything that the courts and the legal system is there to act on behalf of the individual. And if you have a good enough case and you have all of the, you know, all the resources at your disposal, basically, which everyone should be able to have under a fair system, you can prove in a court, you know, that you know, whatever the situation is, you can get what you deserve in good or bad ways. So, you know, this idea that things can be talked out, that it can be rationally, and bureaucratically managed and addressed is a liberal idea. It's an idea that we're kind of brought up believing that, you know, we live in a society where we respect the rights of individuals. We have, you know, documents that go back hundreds of years showing the legal precedents for human rights and maybe even for, you know, environmental rights as well. You know, everybody has a right to clean air. Everybody has a right to clean water. You know, we should protect certain, you know, we have national, what am I trying to say here? National forests. We have certain things in place to protect things just enough so that everybody is sort of given the rights that they supposedly deserve. So I just want to ask, you know, about this idea that we don't actually live in a system like that at all, and that it's a narrative and it's a story that we tell ourselves. And, you know, what I imagine that you very, you know, obviously you witnessed it when you were a public defender and you were defending the oppressed, so to speak, people that were on the blunt end of this thing. But I imagine that you also witnessed it within environmental law as well. So I guess a question about the assumptions that many people have about our liberal democracy and maybe some of the realities that you came up against, and like, what were the stark realities that you ended up kind of becoming exposed to doing this work?
Well, I think the very first thing is we have to understand what's really been happening in the world, what's really going on in the natural world. And what I mean by that is, I think my understanding about the impotence of environmental law to protect the natural world, first comes from just basic history. So the major environmental laws that Americans are so proud of, things like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, these were, almost all passed in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And again, these are, you know, the Endangered Species Act has been called the crown jewel of American environmental law. There's all sorts of superlatives associated with these laws. But if we need to understand what's actually happening in the natural world, and, you know, recently there's been all kinds of reports. Every major, ecosystem on the planet, has been in decline, the destruction has been intensifying since those laws were passed. You know, a couple years ago, there was a report from the Living Planet Index and the World Wildlife Fund that said that since 1970, 60% of all vertebrate wildlife on Earth has been destroyed. That means our laws aren't working. You know, we all saw the story, a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago where, in Germany, you know, so there's vertebrate wildlife, there's invertebrate wildlife, and a study from Germany just said that 75% of insect populations in Germany, had crashed. And they called it the insect apocalypse is here, is what the headline said. So what we're doing isn't working. That's what it says to me. And as a lawyer, I look to the law first, and what it tells me is the laws that we have aren't working. So once I realize that, the obvious question becomes, well, what is it about the legal system? Why is the legal system failing? And the reason that the legal system is failing is quite simply, American law makes true sustainability illegal. Even though we've passed laws like the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act, these laws have not done anything to meaningfully stop the destruction. So I do a lot of work with an organization called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF. They're kind of the premier rights of nature law firm in the world, really. They've been active in this for 25 years. But they've come up with a kind of a tidy explanation of why American law is unsustainable, and they call it the box of allowable activism. And they explained that when activists want to stop a destructive project in their community, and they think they can use the legal system to do so, they quickly learn that they can't do so. And there's primarily four things that are keeping them from stopping destruction in their community. And those four things are, the first one is state preemption. The second, and I'll describe that in more detail. The second one, is a practice in American law where nature is always defined as property, as an object, instead of as a subjective being. The third thing that people run into are corporate civil rights, corporate privilege. Corporations are persons in American law. And then finally, maybe the thing that's most shocking to people is that the regulatory process that we have is actually designed to streamline corporate standards. They actually serve to protect corporations from the outrage of citizens who are witnessing their communities being destroyed. They provide cover for these corporations. They legalize the harm that corporations perform and their projects.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'd like to slow down a little bit and kind of explain these structural problems within American law, this box of allowable activism that makes true sustainability illegal. Like I said, that first one is a legal doctrine called preemption, which basically defines the relationship of municipalities, small communities, cities, to states and the federal government as one of parents to a child. So in American law, local communities are not allowed to pass laws that are more stringent than laws that are already in place at the state and federal level. When communities try to do this, their laws are virtually always struck down on the principle of preemption. And preemption functions to provide businesses with standard rules around the nation. And people, you know, if you were trying to run a business and each jurisdiction that you were operating your business in had different rules, you would have a hell of a time, having a large multinational business, because you would always have to choose the most strict requirements to operate your business under so that you wouldn't offend the law. Politicians understand this, and in order to facilitate business, they want standard laws that everyone can follow. And this is the first thing that keeps communities from being able to protect themselves. The second problem, the second big thing that infects American law is this centuries old tradition of viewing nature only as property. And obviously whenever you define something as property, property is something that can be created, destroyed, discarded. When you gain property rights over land in the United States, for the most part, you gain the right to do whatever you want with that land. If there's a forest on the land, your right to clear cut that forest is protected by American law. Because after all, the trees are only property. They're not living beings. They're simply objects. And this idea is such a moralizing force. You know, so many people base their morality on what is legal and illegal. So when law is teaching people that nature is an object, it's kind of like how the old Abrahamic religions teach that nature is just here for us to use and destroy, and how God gave us this to destroy. Well, American law really codifies that idea by keeping nature as property. So it's that's just an assumption that judges always make. And when communities try and change that, or when activists try and change that, judges are going to say, look, this is how we've operated, the United States for over 300 years. It's precedent. We've been doing it this way forever. We're not going to change it. So that's kind of the second big structural problem in American law. But the third one, and this is something that most everyone should be familiar with, but corporate personhood, corporate civil rights are a major reason why corporations have so much power in the United States. Corporations have many of the same civil rights as American citizens, human citizens have. Corporations have protections of free speech. The whole debate over corporations being able to donate however much money they want to a certain political candidate, that has been decided by the courts. They can do that because they have First Amendment free speech. And when you use your money, that is speech. that's already been settled in American law. And judges are not moving on that. When corporations have as many rights as people do, whenever environmentalists try and, if we use an example, like a corporation, again, buys some land, they now have property rights to that land. They want to clear cut an old growth forest on that land, and environmentalists go to blockade the corporate equipment from going to clear cut. The corporation will file a lawsuit saying, telling the judge, look, these environmentalists are infringing on our corporate rights, on our rights to cut this forest. And and they're going to win because that's already been settled. Corporations have rights in this country.
Yeah.
that is one of the mechanisms when activists, sometimes people hear radicals talking about how corporations have taken over the courts, right? Well, that's how they've taken over the courts. They've succeeded in gaining rulings over the last 200 years that say that they have the same rights as you and I. And then they use those rights whenever somebody wants to stop their destruction. And then the final thing that is preventing any sort of real change in environmental law is the argument that, hey, we have this regulatory process. We've set up the Environmental Protection Agency. Instead of environmentalists trying to physically stop destruction, judges will say you should have gone to the EPA. You should have petitioned the EPA to write stricter regulations that would prevent this. But the problem is these regulatory agencies were never created in the first place to actually stop the harm. They were created again to standardize regulations, to standardize a permitting process that will guarantee to corporations that once they have a permit, they are legally entitled to do what they're permitted to do. Some of the history behind the creation of some of the most famous regulatory agencies is really interesting. Like, one of the very first, agencies that was formed in the United States, regulatory agencies, was the Interstate Commerce Commission, which was largely created at first to regulate the railroad industry. And in the late 1800s, the railroad industry, you know, was one of the most destructive, most ruthlessly capitalistic, businesses, in the country. And the attorney general who was serving at the time that this was, this commission was created was actually, a former railroad attorney himself. And I got the quote right here, but I just want to read it because it explains so much about why the regulatory process doesn't actually protect us. He said, talking about the Interstate Commerce Commission, he said the commission is or can be made of great use to the railroads. It satisfies the popular clamor for a government supervision of railroads at the same time that that supervision is almost entirely nominal. Further, the older such a commission gets to be, the more inclined it will be found to take the business and railroad view of things. He said this in 1894. And I think if we applied this same quote to something like the Environmental Protection Agency, we would see that the older that the EPA has gotten, the more inclined it has been to take the business and corporate view of things. You know, and there's a whole body of legal scholarship that has really risen up in the last century, and it's called it centers on an idea called regulatory capture. And this, you know, so legal scholars have come up with a term for how corporations, it's so prevalent. They've come up with a term for how corporations, inevitably end up taking over the agencies that are supposed to be regulating them. And again, it's a brilliant thing. You have so many people concerned about the environment. So in the 1960s, it was kind of different back then. In the 1960s, environmentalism was much more sentimental. You know, Silent Spring talked a lot about singing birds, that kind of thing. And I've read that it really wasn't controversial. Conservatives and liberals alike considered themselves environmentalists. They everybody had some concern about what was going on. But as this energy got stronger and stronger, they did a brilliant thing. They're like, we can co-opt this energy by creating an agency, which we know will eventually take the business side of things, and it will pacify the people because, oh, we don't have to worry that the environment is being destroyed now, because now we have the Environmental Protection Agency and they're going to take care of everything. They're going to monitor these businesses. And you know, I don't want to say that there hasn't been some good things that came out of these regulatory agencies. You know, it is true that we don't have rivers in the United States that are catching on fire like the Cuyahoga River did in Ohio in the 1960s. But if that's the only way that you judge the success of environmental regulatory agencies, you know, well, at least we don't have burning rivers now.
It's a pretty low bar to set.
It's a super low bar, so all of this has really worked to, it has pacified environmentalism, because so much environmentalism now is about lawsuits, is about trying to use the legal system, despite the fact that we've seen over and over and over again how the legal system won't protect us. And we even, you know, that like CELDEP teaches, there is this box of allowable activism, even though we know not only that the legal system is not protecting us, we know now why the legal system isn't protecting us. And I guess the thing that I'm most passionate about, is trying to tell people, if we know this, why do we keep doing it? Why do we keep going to the courts? Why do we keep making the same mistakes over and over again? It's not working. It's like, you know, and things have gotten so bad, you know, I say this all the time, but 100 species a day are going extinct. We don't have time. Every day that we wait, the loss is almost unthinkable. Every day that we engage in ineffective tactics, is another day that the destruction intensifies, is another defeat in my mind, is every day that passes right now that we're not being effective, is every day that we live in a more impoverished planet, and a planet that is unlikely to recover what we've lost in any sort of time frame that's meaningful to humans.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm a lawyer, and my thing is the legal system isn't going to work. We need to find other tactics.
Yeah. And I completely agree with you, and I'm completely on board. And I really thank you for explaining how that process really works. And I want to point to an article, that was recently published that you and, Sean Butler, published on, DGRnewsservice.org. The title of it is Questioning Unquestioned Beliefs, What the Lake Erie Bill of Rights Teaches Us. And I actually read this last night. And I mean, one, it's, so I have to say, like, I am not a lawyer, so I don't know if you could sense that I don't know how to use the right terminology, or, you know, I'm very like, I don't even know what the right, you know, vocabulary is to describe what's going on here. So I'm speaking completely as a layman, as somebody who, you know, my very limited, exposure to, I guess you could say, the criminal justice system, it's been very limited, but I immediately got the sense that this system isn't working for me at all. This has nothing to do with me. It's something else entirely. But anyway, I just want to point to this article that you had published with Sean Butler, and in it you discuss the attempt to give Lake Erie, I won't even try to summarize it, because again, I'm so, almost insecure about my, about my lack of understanding of when it comes to law. But you know, I think pointing to these really concrete examples where communities who are directly impacted by environmental degradation, you know, from very, like, a very practical thing. I mean, without having even a sentimental, which I think is incredibly important, by the way. Well, I think it's incredibly important to talk about the reality that we are beings on this planet connected to the living earth, and that our systems, our socioeconomic paradigm, everything is disconnecting us from that. And that only when it starts to impact our directly impact our quality of life, do we seemingly really speak up and start doing something. But the first thing that people start to do often is approach the problem legally, right? They try to get their local government, their city government, their state government, their even the federal government to step in and say, hey, our water coming from Lake Erie is toxicified as a result of algae blooms, which are a result of the dairy and agricultural industry in our area. And I mean, I don't know how much in depth you want to get into, but I just want to ask, you know, this is a really good case study of why we need to think outside of the box, so to speak. Because in this article, you and Sean explain step by step what this community tried to do. They went through every single step they legally were required to do to get change enacted. And still, even with all of the things that they did, it didn't stop the algae blooms in the Lake Erie, and in Lake Erie, it didn't stop the pollution and the toxification of their water systems. So I'll just ask however much you wish to go in depth into this, but using this example as a case study as to why all the things you expressed earlier, why that is the case in practically every community around, at least in the United States. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree. I think it is a really good case study, and I'll give a little summary of it, because I think it is really important, to address. We're all taught in our high school civics class, you know, if you want to make change, the way you do it is you vote. you petition you write to your senator, right? And we're told that this is the best way that change is made. We're told how lucky we are that we have these freedoms in the United States. And you know, those tactics again are just not working. Like, how long do we have to watch to know that they're not working? But I think even I can say that, you know, I can, and I have said that and I've tried to tell people, but, I think what has happened in Toledo gives a really good example, and sort of makes what I'm saying hopefully undeniable. But yeah, so, about 5 years ago in August of 2014, which was a really hot summer, the city of Toledo had to shut off city water for 3 days, which left 500,000 people without tap water. And they had to do that because a harmful algae bloom poisoned Lake Erie in the vicinity of Toledo's water intake systems from Lake Erie. So Toledo gets most of its water from Lake Erie, and a harmful algae bloom poisoned the water. Harmful algae blooms produce a really dangerous toxin called microcystin, which, you know, even just on skin contact can cause diarrhea, vomiting, and liver functioning problems. There's starting to become some more solid evidence that there's another neurotoxin in harmful algae blooms called BMAA that causes neurodegenerative illnesses associated with a higher risk of ALS, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's disease. So this is really scary stuff. You know, what could be scarier than not having water? 500,000 people not having water, that we all need water every day. So this happened. And citizens, of course, were outraged, and they started to discuss what they could do. And they were looking around, and they weren't seeing much happening. The Ohio EPA explicitly refused to make determinations that were needed in order to set the proper regulations to make sure that the phosphorus that caused algae bloom, phosphorus that runs off of, it's mainly comes from manure that is produced by concentrated agricultural feed operations, CAFOs. Well, the Ohio EPA, there's no legal mechanism to force them to make the determinations that are needed to set the proper regulations. And in fact, a federal judge, just in 2018, in a published opinion said, look, I know the state hasn't done what it's needed to do. And this is really bad that they're not doing it. However, I don't have any power to force them to do it. So from the very outset, the regulatory framework, the Ohio EPA, failed the people of Toledo. So they realized, well, we can't, appealing to our regulatory agencies isn't going to work. So the citizens in Toledo, they had read about work that the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund had done for Rights of Nature. And they decided that they wanted to bring a citizens initiative within the city of Toledo that would grant Lake Erie rights of nature, and it would give it stripped corporations of their rights. it granted citizens standing to sue on behalf of Lake Erie for harms done to Lake Erie itself. So one thing that in law, if you sue someone, you have to claim that you were injured in some way. And it always, the injury almost always has to be done to humans. And it can be very hard to prove causal links. So by the Lake Erie Bill of Rights, by allowing for citizens to sue for only harm done to the lake, that in itself is kind of a revolutionary idea, because now if the Lake Erie Bill of Rights would stand, all that you would have to prove is that there's too much phosphorus in the water to get a court order to stop major industrial agricultural operations from polluting. So Ohio, some states have what's called a citizens initiative process, which allows citizens themselves to draft the law. They have to gather a lot of signatures to place that ballot or place that law on the ballot. And then the people can directly vote on the law and say whether they want that law enacted or not. This is usually, again, going back to our high school civics class, usually it's our state legislatures and the federal legislature that writes laws and then votes on them and enacts them. And in many ways that system of only allowing legislatures, only allowing elected representatives to write laws was one of the ways that, the so-called founding fathers, were trying to, soften the effect of, really majority rule. And they were very suspicious of the masses, and they didn't want the masses to be able to write their own laws.
Mm-hmm.
So people in Ohio are lucky because they actually have this citizens initiative process. So the people in Toledo drafted the Lake Erie Bill of Rights, which, that's one step. It is hard to write a law, but they did that. Then they went through another really hard step, which is they gathered, they had to gather, over 5,000 signatures in order to just get the law on the ballot. And they had to do that primarily in the summer of 2018, also very hot, involving people on the streets. It involves, you have to organize a lot of people to go out, collect the signatures, make sure that there's no duplicate signatures. My point here is it's a huge grassroots effort to gather the signatures needed to place something on the ballot. So they did that. They got all of the signatures and, they submitted it to the ballot board, the local governmental unit responsible for placing things on the ballot. And they were, it was challenged in the Ohio Supreme Court. People said, people challenged the placing this on the ballot, saying that rights of nature are unconstitutional, saying all the things that I described a little while ago, that this would infringe on corporate rights. You can't do that. This would infringe on preemption. The state has already passed this. Well, the state has already refused to enforce regulations. So the people can't now make them enforce the regulations. So there's actually two challenges in the Ohio Supreme Court, and the Ohio Supreme Court ultimately allowed allowed the law to go onto the ballot. But again, just to highlight that, in order to defend a lawsuit in the Supreme Court, that requires lawyers, that requires a lot of work from lawyers. That takes a long time. It takes a lot of energy and resources while you're going through that. But they did it, and their arguments were persuasive enough that it got on the ballot.
Mm. Okay.
So now it's on the ballot, and now people are starting to pay attention. British Petroleum North America actually wired $302,000 to the people opposing the law. Meanwhile, the grassroots group spent just under $8,000.
Wow.
In the campaign to vote on the law. But in the end, the people of Toledo, passed the law. They voted, 61% of the people who voted, in the election said, yes, we want Lake Erie to have a Bill of Rights. We want Lake Erie to have rights of nature. Enough is enough. It's time that we actually get serious about cleaning up Lake Erie. Well, just a few hours after the city of Toledo actually certified the election results, a farm business, a member of the Ohio Farm Bureau, a company called the Jarvis Farms Partnership, sued the city, asking for what's called an injunction against enforcing the law. They basically, that's legalese for judge, this law is unconstitutional, don't let it go into effect. So the city of Toledo actually agreed not to fight the temporary injunction. So, the city of Toledo now is charged with enforcing the law because it's the will of the people. They do actually have the option to say, we're not going to enforce the law, which is another lesson for people. Even if you get a law passed, even if you do the traditional thing, you're successful at getting a legislature to pass a law. The executive branch, the city, doesn't have to enforce it. So even if we did something major, like tried to get a constitutional amendment through the American Senate, and the American states to, you know, like a rights of nature constitutional amendment, there's no guarantee that it will be enforced even if it's on the books.
Wow.
So right now the case is still held up. It's likely that the Lake Erie Bill of Rights is going to be dismissed at any time. After the city of Toledo agreed to the temporary suspension of the law, the organization, the grassroots people who kind of masterminded the Lake Erie Bill of Rights, tried to do what's called intervening in the case, which is a legal term for when a party has some sort of interest in the outcome of a case and realizes that the people who should be on their side aren't going to do a very good job arguing for that case. There, in American law, you can sometimes join the case and be able to argue on behalf of a certain cause. Federal district judge denied their ability to intervene. They appealed to the next level of federal courts, which is the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. They denied their intervention. So now there is no one who was actually involved in writing the Lake Erie Bill of Rights, who was involved in getting the Lake Erie Bill of Rights passed. There's no one involved in the case right now that is going to be able to argue on behalf of the Lake Erie Bill of Rights. So, you know, any day now a ruling could come out that the Lake Erie Bill of Rights has been, invalidated. The people of Toledo have exhausted every political and legal remedy they have for this. And, Lake Erie is being poisoned. More phosphorus is running into Lake Erie. More industrial agricultural operations are moving into the area. There's been stories all spring and summer. It's been very rainy in Ohio in the upper Midwest, and it's likely that the algae blooms are going to be as bad or worse as they've ever been. And the people simply have no recourse at this point.
You know, I want to quote something here, and this was in the article about this, and it's from the, as you mentioned, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. And what it says here is, much like using single matches to illuminate a painting in a dark room, enough matches need to be struck simultaneously and burn long enough so that the painting can be viewed in its entirety. Each municipality is a match, and each instance of a law being overturned as violative, am I saying that correctly? Violative,
yes.
Yeah, violative of these legal doctrines is an opportunity for people to see how the structure actually functions. This does the necessary work of penetrating the denial, piercing the illusion of democracy, and removing the blinders that prevent a large majority of people from seeing the reality on the ground. So the reason why I wanted you to, partly, obviously, just to understand it, but the reason why I wanted you to explain this case, because I'm sure that there's numerous other ones that we could cite, but that one, when you explained it there and when I read it in this article that you had published, it just shows you, like, anytime there's an argument about going and voting and voting, you know, voting, vote for, if it doesn't work, vote for different people that are come in and be more favorable to what you want to get done. You know, do ballot initiatives if possible, you know, work with the legal system to get this stuff done. And what you have explained and what these people of Toledo have experienced is no. Actually, that doesn't work at all. We've done everything we can. We've raised as much money as we could. We did all the grassroots organizing that was possible. And even with everything that we have done, still, it was struck down. And I think while many people would look at that as, oh, that's incredibly disheartening and depressing and disempowering, what you're arguing, what I sense that you're arguing is that, okay, now that we have communities that are becoming increasingly aware of how the system actually works, and not in their favor by any means, and not in the favor of the natural world by any means at all, that we can then think a little outside the box of what we should be doing to protect these places, to protect these lakes and rivers and forests and everything that we need. I mean, if we're going to be more honest about what humanity's role on this planet is, I think it's to come into recognition again of how interconnected everything truly is. And that when Lake Erie, for instance, is being polluted and creating these toxic algae blooms, it's not just about the fact that you don't have access to water. It's also just recognizing that this is, this cuts through every single aspect of our culture and our society, in which corporations and business interests are above everything. Whether it's about the quality of human life or the quality of other non-human life as well, you know, we don't have a legal system, we don't have a governmental system that really does anything to address this in any fundamentally important ways. So, I don't know how to segue into this, but just really the point that I think you've made is that, you know, we need to consider a different approach here. And what is that different approach? If I could open that up to you.
Let me say from the outset that I think that I argue for direct confrontation with the forces that are destroying the planet. The only way that we're going to save the planet is if we dismantle industrial infrastructure. You know, we know what is destroying the world. We know that combustion of fossil fuels is producing climate change, for example. We know that the expansion of agricultural operations, of industrialization, destroys habitat for the species we share this beautiful planet with. We know what is causing the problems. And And if we're going to stop environmental destruction, we have to actually stop environmental destruction. We can't ask other people to do it for us. So like I said, I argue for dismantling industrial infrastructure. I think that morally we're obligated to do this as quickly as possible. The longer that we wait, the less of a planet is going to be left. And, we don't have any time to waste. So more specifically, I argue for things like sabotage. There are miles and miles and miles of undefended, pipelines of relatively unguarded, hubs where, things like fossil fuels are produced, are refined. And if this culture doesn't have access to its lifeblood, to fossil fuels, then it can't keep destroying. You have to be able to fill the backhoe with oil or gas in order for it to operate. Unfortunately, not a lot of people are ready to hear this or want to hear this. And unfortunately, as much as I wish that there was a serious militant resistance movement forming that was willing to consider these more direct approaches, that just doesn't seem to be the case. So when I realized that, it's one thing for me to, you know, get on a podcast or get on my computer and type up an argument for attacking industrial infrastructure. I think it's more effective to actually, experientially show people why the tactics that they've been taught to believe in, aren't working. You know, when I say something like, we need to dismantle industrial infrastructure, we need to, consider tactics like sabotage. People say, well, we don't need to do that. We can file lawsuits. We can get the right candidates in office. But what the example of what has happened in Toledo is showing people is that it doesn't work, you know, and you can waste. I don't want to say that the people of Toledo wasted their time. But imagine if they already knew that everything that they were going to try back in 2014 wasn't going to work. Could we have stopped something? Because again, nothing has been stopped in Toledo. The lake is still being poisoned. The algae bloom's getting worse. You know, for all of the efforts that we've done in Toledo, nothing physically has changed. So that quote that you just read about, you know, much like using single matches to illuminate a painting in a dark room, I think that we have to show people, and the reason that I keep doing law work is to, from the outset, tell people, I don't think this is going to work. I'm a lawyer. I'm telling you this, but if you still don't believe me and you want to go through the process, I'll go through that process with you. And then, hopefully those people, through their blood, sweat, and tears that they poured into this, when at the end of the campaign, when they haven't achieved what they thought they were going to, there is going to be a moment where people are angry and they're energized, and they have, for the last 5 years, honed their organizing skills, built relationships within their communities, really put together a framework for a truly serious resistance movement. And I want to be there when those people do experience that anger to say, there's other things we can try. The legal system is not the end all be all. It is not the last thing. You know, now it's time to think about how we can directly challenge, physically challenge what is happening, actually shut down the forces that are destroying the planet, that are poisoning Lake Erie. You know, and to me, that does require physical and perhaps armed confrontation. You know, there's what it what is it that we're actually trying to do through the legal system? When we file a lawsuit, what is it that we're actually trying to do? And to me, at the very basic level, what we're trying to do is we're trying to get the judge to order men and women with guns, armed men and women with guns, the police, the National Guard, in Canada, the RCMP. We're trying to get the judge to order the police to act on our behalf. So if we file a lawsuit against a corporate project and we're successful in getting a judge to rule that project shouldn't go on, the real power behind the judge's decision is the judge's ability to, if that corporation disobeys the judge's order, the judge now has the power to order the police to go stop the corporation. So if we know that the legal system doesn't work for us, cut out the middleman. We don't need it to be the state's police that are protecting us. Why don't we learn how to protect ourselves is my big point. Why don't we skip the last, like in Toledo, why don't we skip the last 5 years of truly grueling work of using all those resources? And what if we started to think about, you know, our own police forces or, our own more militant tactics, and instead of wasting time, precious time where we're losing so much, why don't we skip that step and get right to it and stop the destruction?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I endorse everything you're saying, and that's why I wanted you on here, because you could explain, you know, and I just think about what the people of Toledo must, what kind of, I hope anyway that there is this question that's coming up in their minds. Maybe they've discussed it. Maybe they're not willing to say it yet, but like what this, you know, quote here talking about matches illuminating a painting. And if you have enough of these experiences, enough people, and I mean, this is the thing that I'm frustrated with, but you know, if you have enough communities around the United States, having these experiences of being, of trying to do everything they can through the processes that were supposed to be benefiting us or been told that are supposed to benefit us in the long term. And you spend years and years and years on a campaign, and it just gets completely shut down at the final stages when everything should actually be working in your favor. You know, I feel a sense of impatience with that because, well, I feel like it's probably necessary and it's good that it's coming about in any way that it is. I mean, if this is what it takes for people to recognize and to kind of wake up, I guess, then so be it. But Will, like you know, and we all probably listening know, we don't really, to say that we have time, we don't. You know, there is no time to be messing around with these types of things. So the conundrum for me is like, yes, let them do their campaigning and try to get ballot initiatives and all that stuff done if they can, because that may be what's required to get them to think more radically about these things. But the other part of me is like, we don't actually have time to wait for people to come to their senses in a way. And that isn't meant to sound like arrogant or anything like that, but there is this sort of real process that unfolds in people's lives where they begin to really see how the systems work, and they can then take that experience and it can radicalize them, you know, and all of us have gone through experiences in our lives where we had one assumption that was challenged through maybe a series of experiences, and it may take years for people to come to any real, real conclusions that are actually useful and helpful. But again, that's the problem, is that we don't actually have time for that. So I'm like, okay, let people do that, but we need more and more people to come into this awareness and this understanding and actually commit themselves to direct action. And, I honestly don't know how to reconcile those two stances that I have, because I don't know what is going to be required to get people to really take those steps. you know, and I guess maybe if I could ask this, and we've been talking well over an hour at this point, so I don't know how much longer you want to talk about this, but I do think that there is an interesting question here of, mass collective action, where we see maybe very large groups of people going on strike, sit-ins, you know, what would be maybe direct action, but is essentially nonviolent, but direct, versus a small dedicated group of people going about their business, doing things that the majority maybe are unwilling to do. And maybe seeing that there's value in both of those, paths, but more and more I'm thinking about, well, what's actually required and who's willing to do it. And it's not going to be popular. It's not necessarily something that everybody's going to want to jump on board with, but, that's kind of where I'm at, you know, personally speaking, where I'm like, okay, we need to do something. Something has to be done. Do we really need to build a mass movement to accomplish these goals? Do you know what I mean?
I think,
yeah.
Yeah. That's really, you're really getting to the heart of it. It's, and I'm really glad that you brought that up. The first thing I want to say that I should have said earlier is every fiber of my being wishes that we could do this in a nonviolent way. Like I'm not a violent person. I am one of the most conflict averse people you will meet to a fault. I don't like thinking about this stuff. However, and it is true. If we had the numbers, we probably could shut this thing down quickly.
Yeah.
You know, if we had the numbers, and I wish we did, but we've been waiting for a mass movement to form for decades and it's not forming. And we don't, again, I keep saying this, we don't have time to wait for a mass movement to form. The one way I always think about it is if you were walking through on the street and you saw a child being beaten on the street, would you look around and try and gather friends to try and stop it? Or would you immediately react and do what you can right now to try and stop it? I don't think any of us would waste time, you know, at least I would hope none of us would waste time. We would just go and stop it. And that's the situation, you know, on a global scale is infinitely worse than that. And I think we need to start thinking like that. Like we don't have time to let another 100 species go extinct. I think, you know, just technically and practically speaking, a mass movement is taking too long to form. And we need to start thinking that, you know, we're not going to have that much more help than what we've already put together right now. And we need to start thinking about what can we do with the numbers and the resources that we have right now. And I think we need to drop this belief that, one, we need a mass movement, because I don't think we need a mass movement to stop it. And two, that we should build a mass movement. We need to lose those ideas. And then, you know, a lot of people, you were saying too, like it's going to be very unpopular and it is true. Our culture is just not, we are not at a place where people, understand this. The vast majority of people are going to be really angry if stuff like this starts to form. And for me personally, I'm not someone that, it has any skills to really engage in the kind of actions that I'm talking about. But I think for people like me who don't have those skills, we really need to start publicly normalizing these tactics, expressing our support for them and trying to, you know, convince enough people that like, if this stuff starts to happen, this isn't a good thing. It's not a bad thing. And we need to support the people that are doing it. as best we can. So I kind of lost my train of thought there, but I think that's where we need to be moving, and we don't have time for a mass movement. But frankly, we've seen how long it's taken. And it's just each day that passes, less of the world is left. You know, our children are going to live in a more impoverished planet the longer this goes on. Whole species are just lost. And I believe we have a moral responsibility to them to do what it takes to protect them too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I am completely in agreement. Jesus, I'm having a hard time talking. Sorry, Will. I'm in agreement with you. And I wanted to ask, and I'm sorry it took me so long to ask. We're getting kind of closer to the end of this interview, but you do have a book coming out, coming out next month, right? Is it August? I think.
Yeah.
And the title of that is, How Dams Fall, on representing the Colorado River in the first ever American lawsuit seeking rights for a major ecosystem. In a future interview, I think when the book does come out, I would like to read it, and I would like to hopefully interview you, potentially more specifically on that book. But, I'm excited to read it when it comes out. But if you could talk just a little bit about that and let people know, like, what you're conveying through this book and all of that, that would be great.
Yeah, it's, the first thing to say is it's a pretty short book. It's more like a really long essay. I helped to file, the first ever Rights of Nature lawsuit for the Colorado River, in the fall of 2017. The Colorado River was the plaintiff in that case. So the case was actually captioned as Colorado River versus the state of Colorado. So in many ways, well, not in many ways, very literally, the Colorado River was my client in that case. So with that idea, I decided that I wanted to travel as much of the Colorado River as I could, getting to know my client. Just like if a human client walked into my office, some of the first things I would ask are, you know, tell me about yourself. Who are you and what do you need? So that's what I did in this book, is I asked the Colorado River very seriously and sincerely who she is and what she needs. And it was incredible the things that I learned asking those questions. And this book is what I heard the Colorado River say to me. It is lyrical and poetic. It's not a book of legal analysis like we're talking here. It's very much a lyrical exploration of my and this culture's relationship with the Colorado River. And I hope people like it.
I'm sure they will. You're a beautiful writer. I mean, you're able to do, I think, a couple different things with your writing, which is, as you said, your book is lyrical. So there is you've written poetry. You write very beautifully, about these subjects, but you're also very, very capable of writing it's approachable, but it's very dense, writing on laws and kind of the legal process, like that article I mentioned in this interview, that goes over the whole process. It explains everything. So you're able to do both of those things very well. So I think people will enjoy it. I'm excited to read it. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Yeah. So aside from your book coming out in, August next month, people can find more about you, find out more about you at your website, willfalk.org. Also, we did mention the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which I will provide a link to their website as well. Are there any other resources or any other things that you'd like to direct people towards?
Yeah, I mentioned the People of Toledo. The group that is really spearheaded that campaign is a group called Toledoans for Safe Water. And I'd recommend checking out their stuff. You can read the Lake Erie Bill of Rights. And I just want to explain that those people are truly heroes. While it hasn't gone the way they wanted it to, they poured in a tremendous amount of effort. It's just an interesting thing to follow their story too.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'll be sure to link people to that. I just want to give people all the proper resources so they can maybe do some more research into this. But Will, I really thank you for taking time to speak with me today and to go over all this information. I think you're, as I've maybe said numerous times in this interview, but because of your background, because of your experiences, you are, I think, one of the best people to convey this information. So I really thank you for doing what you're doing, and thank you for taking time to speak with me today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to support this project monetarily, here are a few options. You can send a one-time donation through PayPal. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast and you can treat that a bit like a tip jar. If you like this episode or any other episode of this podcast in particular, consider throwing a few bucks Patrick's way. That would be really helpful. If you would really like to sustain this work and support this project more regularly, consider supporting this project through Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/lastbornthewilderness, you can donate to the production of this podcast for $1 or more a month. And by doing that, you'll gain early access to these interviews and discussions before the official public release. And you will have access to some exclusive content there as well. As the great psychedelic bard Terence McKenna said, "Take it easy, dude, but take it."